Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show. Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. Welcome to your Friday. Today is June 23rd. The month is clipping by. And I always say happy Friday, but, you know, it's not always happy. For some people, they just have a lot on their plate today. And if you are in a place of distress and anxiety, I just want you to know we're thinking about you and we're praying for you and we're loving on you, because sometimes what you need is just a little bit of a listening love and support and encouragement. And sometimes you don't need to be told what to do or get a finger shaken at you or anything. You just need arms around you. So that's what we're doing for you right now, if that's where you're at today. So we've got a Bible giveaway this. We're giving one Bible away every week this month. And if you want to clarify your understanding of God's insight on financial management with the Financial Stewardship Bible, that was developed in collaboration with Howard Dayton from MoneyWise. These Bibles have got 2,000 highlighted verses illuminating God's perspective on stewardship, provision, and trust. So to sign up to try to win one of these Bibles, go to myfaithradio.com and you can sign up to win one. What I know about money is that money is the root of all big bank accounts. That's what I know, which isn't much. Here's something I kind of found interesting, too. If you are in Italy, and there's one airport in Italy that's bending the rules, the airport is allowing passengers to bring pesto in their carry-on baggage. Passengers are allowed to bring 500 grams of pesto on their flights. It's really because the airport has decided to change the rule, because it was confiscating hundreds and hundreds of pesto jars and tossing them away. An official said, come on, that's a waste of food, and it's annoying passengers, so let them take the pesto on their trip. And in Minneapolis, there was a hacker who called himself Vigilance, and he's reporting an attack on the University of Minnesota computer system. He said that he used a flaw in the university's system and sent an email to several reporters from the U.S. server. University officials would not confirm whether a server was illegally accessed, but the hacker claimed to be retaliating against a jury's acquittal of the police officer who killed Philando Castile, a very emotional issue for sure. We have on our studio line Adam Holtz from Plugged In Ministries. We're going to talk movies with Adam, and we're also going to talk about the way we view movies and how we critique them, and Adam's got a good response to that. So we'll take a little break. When we come back, Adam Holtz is up next. It's 8 minutes after the hour. Good morning. I just cracked my knuckles. Did you hear that on the air? Oh, good. What a relief. So I just heard like somebody stepped on a bag of potato chips. That was me cracking my knuckles. I thought, oh, I hope that didn't come across on the air. Oh, good. Rebecca just gave me the nope, that didn't come across. Welcome back to the big show. I have Adam Holtz on the line from Plugged In Ministries, and there's a bunch of new movies out. I don't really attend movies. I stay home and pray and repent. Adam, good morning.
Good morning, Bill. How are you?
I'm good. So a friend of mine went and saw Cars 3, took his three kids, and he said it was quite fun, and he loved it, even though he nodded off halfway through, but that's just his age.
You know what? Here's my confession. I nodded off halfway through, too, so must be my age also.
Okay. Let's talk about Cars 3.
Well, Cars 3 brings us back to another adventure with Lightning McQueen, who is the sarcastic and cocky racer that we met in the first movie all the way back in 2006, if you can believe it. It's been 11 years since that movie came out. And the second film dealt with Mater, his cohort, voiced by Larry the Cable Guy, becoming kind of an accidental spy. And people didn't really like it very well. And this one returns to a much more sort of standard narrative, very similar to the first Cars movie. Lightning, of course, is aging, and we know in the sports world of any kind that getting old is almost always bad.
Mm-hmm.
So he's struggling to compete against a new generation of faster, better, bigger, you know, just all around better race cars, and is sort of thinking about hanging it up. And in the midst of that, has a terrible, terrible accident, has to go through rehab, has to decide whether he's going to try to make a comeback or not. And he has a trainer named Cruz Ramirez who helps him, who's a young female car, and she's got some racing dreams of her own. And then he has an older mentor who helps him as well. So, honestly, it's basically Rocky 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 7, you know,
mm-hmm.
pick.
Yeah.
Only with animated cars.
Okay.
I really liked it. My family were big Cars fans and have probably contributed a fair bit to the bottom line on the estimated $10 billion of merchandising this franchise has done since 2006. So,
wow.
You know, there are a few little wink-wink, slightly off-color jokes, but nothing that, you know, your average 6 or 8 or even 10-year-old is even going to pick up on. This is a fun movie. I liked it a lot, even though, as I mentioned, I did fall asleep.
Okay. give me a real positive walk away from this movie.
Well, I mean, it's a movie about being honest about where you're at. It's a movie about courage. It's a movie about competition.
Nice.
And it's a movie about helping other people,
mm-hmm.
or other cars in this case.
Mm-hmm. And like a lot of movies, I mean, as you watched cartoons as a kid, and then you watched as an adult, you saw all kinds of stuff that it never registered at all as a kid. So
right.
I suppose there's always a little of that because, you know, these movie makers know that adults are going to be coming and they can slip little stuff in and kids aren't going to get it, right?
Yeah, that's true. Although I will say, boy, there is almost none of that here. There's really no sexual innuendo at all, other than to say that Lightning and his friend Sally are boyfriend and girlfriend. You know, that's about it. In the spiritual content section, there's a bumper sticker that reads Karmast, which is obviously a play on the Hindu phrase Namast,
mm-hmm.
or Namaste, excuse me.
Yeah.
But I was pleased that they didn't indulge that impulse to give jokes or give parents the little winking nudge that sometimes happens in movies like this.
Mm-hmm. And so we're not really having a lot of negative content or elements to this movie at all, huh?
No, not really. I mean, probably the biggest thing is there's the nasty car wreck, and so for sensitive kids who really like Lightning McQueen, it might be momentarily difficult, but, I mean, he's okay. It's not like he dies. So, in some ways, that's probably the biggest problem here.
Okay. Let's talk about the Transformers, The Last Night.
Let's talk about the Transformers, The Last Night. You know, Bill, I have to confess, when I saw the commercial for this, I thought, this one actually looks kind of cool.
Okay.
Maybe it was the dragon or the medieval, you know, knight's theme or Anthony Hopkins. I mean, Anthony Hopkins in it, how bad can it be,
right?
Yeah,
it can't be that bad. No, that's pretty cool.
No, it's terrible, Bill.
Okay.
All hopes can die right here.
Okay.
It is a frenetic, can't say that word this
morning. That's all right.
Mind-numbing experience of just cacophony and explosions and more explosions, as David Letterman would have said back in the day, from start to finish. And occasionally Anthony Hopkins and Mark Wahlberg and a few other people pop up, you know, on the human side of things, but the basic upshot is there are more robots in disguise invading Earth again, and this time we have a female robotic entity named Quintessa, who claims to be a god who created Optimus Prime,
mm-hmm.
and she wants to blow up the Earth again. I mean, that's pretty much the bottom line.
Okay, any violent content or sexual content in this one?
Oh, yeah, we've got a little bit of everything here. In addition to that spiritual content, as has been the case in all the Transformer movies, the female lead, her name is Vivian, and she's an Oxford professor, wears really form-fitting and low-cut outfits the whole time. Violence is just, it's just nonstop, Bill. And most of it is robots being destroyed in all sorts of ways, but there are obviously human casualties as well. And I think the biggest issue for families might be the profanity here. There are a couple of F words and about 35 S words.
Wow.
Man, it just feels like a lot. I'm like, guys, can't you make one of these movies without indulging that impulse to ratchet up the profanity tally that high? And then there are a bunch of other more mild profanities as well. And I think as a parent, I could probably deal with the crazy violence because I'm a good American after all.
Mm-hmm.
But the profanity is what pushes it out of bounds for me to even remotely consider my kids seeing this.
Okay. Well, here's one of the slogans that we will put on our website coming from you, which is all hopes can die right here.
All hopes can die right here,
yeah.
Like most of the Transformers in large chunks of the earth do.
All right, Adam, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, more with Adam Holtz. It is 16 minutes after the hour. We'll be right back. It is 18 minutes after the hour. Good morning. I'm talking to Adam Holtz from Plugged In Ministries. The next movie I want to discuss is 47 meters. Doesn't sound like a great distance, but when you're trapped underwater, 47 meters, and there's sharks circling, that can be scary. Now, frankly, sharks don't come into my house, and I don't go into theirs. So this is probably not a movie that I'm going to be going to see.
Yeah, well, this is a movie about two sisters who go to Mexico on vacation, and one of them has just broken up with her boyfriend, who basically left her because he said she was boring. And so to prove that she's not boring, she and her sister meet these two guys who have a connection with this really sketchy shark cage dropping outfit,
mm-hmm.
and they take them out in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico, and wouldn't you know it, the cable on the cage breaks, and they fall to the bottom of the ocean. And so the next 90 minutes or so are them, the two women, trying to figure out how are they going to get back to the surface with, as you said, lots of great white sharks, in this case digitally created ones, blocking the way. And when you're 47 meters down or about 150 feet, the other problem is you're going to get the bends going back up. So
mm-hmm.
they have to take a five-minute break halfway up, which, if you're thinking to yourself, that seems dangerous with sharks in the water, you are right. Difficult. So it's funny. Every time a shark movie comes out, almost like clockwork, we hear the best shark movie since Jaws.
Mm-hmm.
And my response for those who said that about this movie was, have you seen any shark movies since Jaws? Because this is not the best shark movie since Jaws. It was a movie that was supposed to go straight to DVD, and at the last moment, when another shark movie, last summer's The Shallows with Blake Lively, did well, they said, hey, maybe we can make some money on this. So they called the semis full of DVDs back and decided to release it in theaters, and probably direct DVD would have been a better approach.
Adam, I remember seeing Jaws when I was, I don't know, must have been high school or something, then I was sitting in a packed theater. And
yeah.
you know when that head kind of pops out and floats by?
Yeah. Yep.
The woman sitting next to me, complete total stranger, dug her fingernails into my arm so deep.
You still have scars today?
I still have scars. Yeah, yeah. So anyway, this movie, it sounds like rebellion against the boyfriend. I will show you. I'm going to go to Mexico. It sounds like there's going to be plenty of opportunities for bad language, drug and alcohol content, and skimpy bathing suits. That's my guess.
Well, we have skimpy bathing suits, and we have some bad language. You know, as these sorts of films go, this one, probably the biggest content issue is just the violence that happens to these women. And a couple of the guys on the boat try to rescue them, and I don't think it's probably a huge spoiler warning to say that that doesn't go very well. So as these sorts of thrillers go, there's not a huge amount amount of content. They do go out drinking and go to a bar one night before they go out the next day, but it wasn't terrible on that count. It was just a terrible movie.
Yeah. Okay. Any positive takeaways on this one? Trying to be
optimistic.
Well,
you know, I think that you've got these two sisters who, once they realize the predicament that they're in, they're both willing to do whatever it takes to save the other one.
And okay.
They both have chances to act really heroically and sacrificially, trying to save each other. So that was positive.
Oh, good. Okay. Now, Adam, an MTV writer was critiquing Christian movies. Can you weigh in on that?
I can. Her name was Rachel Handler, and about 10 days ago, she had an article called "What Does Christian Netflix Want from Us?" And she was watching several of the most popular movies from the Christian film distributor PureFlix, and these include I'm Not Ashamed, God's Not Dead 2, I Am Gabriel, and Allison's Choice. And she sort of tongue-in-cheek asked the question of each one, what does it mean to be pure? And how do those films answer that question? And this was a really sarcastic, cutting, demeaning, mocking sort of assessment of these movies. She says at one point, PureFlix is just like Netflix, but for families of faith, specifically the faith that sees earthly life as a filthy pit stop on the way to heaven, populated by millions of feckless, hellbound sinners in need of salvation. And that sort of tone permeates the whole thing. And for me, the article just made me kind of sad, and it illustrated how hard it is to try to communicate with people who are not where we're at, and even well-meaning attempts at telling stories that could connect with people. There are still a lot of people out there that really don't see us as offering the good news that we offer. So it was a pretty sobering examination of Christian movies from an outsider's perspective.
Mm-hmm. And now we've got, hard to believe I'm saying this, but we are looking at the 4th of July coming up, you know, pretty soon. And, you know, we're going to start thinking as families what we're going to do. And is there some really good movies that we can put on the list,
list
of things
to
watch?
An eye on is Spider-Man Homecoming, which I believe comes out on the 4th or thereabouts. The 4th is weird this year. I think it's on, a Tuesday?
Mm-hmm.
Something like that. So I think it comes out the weekend before. And but don't quote me on that because I don't have my calendar right in front of me. It's in that neck of the woods.
Okay.
This will be, it's called Spider-Man Homecoming. It's yet another reboot. So this will be, the third reboot since 2001? But this one will be integrating Spider-Man with the other Marvel Universe characters, the Avengers. Tony Stark plays a big role in this one. So it's bringing Spider-Man into the Marvel Cinematic Universe fold. I'm hopeful that they don't push the boundaries too much since the main character is a high schooler. And if you've seen the trailers, you know he looks like just a geeky kid. He's not a 25-year-old buff guy, but he looks like a pimple-faced high schooler. And so we haven't had a chance to see it yet, but that definitely is the biggest release coming out over the 4th of July holiday window.
Awesome. Well, Adam, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for being on the show, and I'll look forward to our next opportunity to talk.
Sounds good, Bill. Thank you.
Yeah, have a great weekend. It is 25 minutes after the hour. We'll take a short break, and then when we come back, after some news, we're going to talk to Chris Martin, the millennial evangelical. We'll be back in a minute. It is half past. When we come back, we're going to talk to Chris Martin, the millennial evangelical. And millennials are much more likely to flourish financially if they follow the success sequence. Let's find out what that is. Stay tuned. We'll be back with more. Good morning. It's 25 minutes until the top of the hour. You know, for believers, it's so easy to get caught up in how the culture defines success. Trevin Wax talks more about this and offers ideas on how to think and act differently.
We live in a culture in which a lot of people chart the story of their own life based on their accumulation of wealth or status or moving up in their career. for example. So a lot of people will look at the previous year that they've lived, and they will ask questions based on, did they get ahead? Did they fall behind? Did they have any financial setbacks? Are they moving forward? Did they get a promotion? They chart the story of their life as if the career or as if success or as if financial stability is at the center. That's how a lot of people in our Western society, living the American dream, that's how they think of their life. And yet the Christians should be asking different questions. It's not that questions about career are not important, but they can't be at the center. We should be asking questions about the previous year to say, have we become more like Christ in the previous year? Have we grown in our discipleship? Have we grown in our holiness? It could be that a setback in business is actually what propels us forward in our relationship with Jesus, and it could be that more success in business in 1 year may actually set us back some in our growth and our discipleship. We have to have an entirely different way of looking at our lives, the stories of our life, how we judge success, failure, moving forward, backward, and things like that. And so it's just so easy for us, though, to slip into the patterns and the mindsets of the world and to begin to interpret our own life, to tell our own story in the exact same way that other people in our society tell their own story. And when we do that, we really don't look that different from the people around us.
You want to hear that full interview, go to myfaithradio.com and type in, how do you define success? And that'll take you to Trevin Wax. He's a writer for the Gospel Coalition, very clever guy. Actually, we're going to be talking to him in the next couple of weeks. We're looking forward to discussing his new book, which I can't remember the name of, but we will get to that soon. All right, after a short break, we're going to talk to our friend Chris Martin. Be back in just a minute.
Mistakes are obviously best avoided, but part of growing up is understanding that nobody's perfect, not even parents. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. It's inevitable that everyone fails. The trick is knowing how to fail forward. It means learning from your mistakes and keeping yourself from repeating them. So here are a few ways you can practice failing forward in your own life. First, admit when you're wrong. Don't make excuses. And second, apologize to those you hurt. And third, ask your teen what the consequences should be for your own failures and carry through. Remember, your teen will blow it one day. But if you teach them how to fail forward, you'll give them an invaluable tool for every stage of life.
Find more parenting help from Mark Gregston when you go online to parentingtodaysteens.org.
Good morning. It's almost 20 minutes until the top of the hour, so if you have to be at work at the top of the hour, you've got a little bit of time left. Just enough time to listen to our conversation with Chris Martin. And also, Trevin Wax, that new book of his is called This Is Our Time, Everyday Myths in Light of the Gospel. And Chris Martin, we like to think of him as our millennial evangelical. Chris, good morning.
Hey, good morning. It's so funny you talk about Trevin. He and I are, we both work at Lifeway. We're both really good friends. We're actually going to lunch together today. So it's, he'll be great on your show later when you have him on.
Oh, you just one up me.
I'm not trying to one up anybody. It's just funny to hear. I texted him 2 minutes ago when I was funny. Hearing his voice. I'm like, dude, they're playing a clip of you right before they're having
me
on.
That's great. That's great. So, congratulations. Your Cubs took batting practice yesterday over Miami, 11-1
yeah,
victory.
Exactly.
You must have felt good about that.
Yeah, it was fun to watch, and then it got kind of boring. But,
yeah, exactly.
But yeah, it's funny.
Too one-sided.
We send our big slugger down to the minor leagues, and then we go off on people. It's crazy.
All right. Chris, where do we start here today? Let's get going with millennials and the success sequence, which I teased the audience with.
Sure.
What is that sequence?
Yeah, you know, it's not completely clear. It's not really simple. But in this new study published by Wendy Wang and W. Bradford Wilcox of the Institute for Family Studies, talk about how millennials have different paths to adulthood. And as we've talked about on the show a number of times, sometimes they sort of delay adulthood. But by their data and kind of what they show, millennials take different paths to adulthood, but the success sequence tends to be sort of what we understand to be the traditional sequence. In this study, they're talking a lot about how millennials are having kids before they're married, living together before they're married. In fact, one of the most interesting stats they have here in a graph right at the beginning is that over half of millennial parents have had a baby before marriage or are still unwed. So 55% of millennials have had a kid before they're married or they never got married, and 45% have had a kid after marriage. So I think the point of this big study they released just last week that I've unfortunately have not had the opportunity to write about, but I've read the majority of, they basically talk about how millennials in economic situations can often be determined by the sequence in which they reach adulthood. So one of the more interesting statistics as well was that they showed that millennials who have children before they're married tend to be in poorer financial situations or economic situations than those who have children after they're married.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, it's hard to draw a causative relationship there. Like, you don't want to take that data necessarily and say, because you had a kid before you were married, you will be worse off financially.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily because of that, but there is a positive correlation there, meaning that there does seem to be a relationship between those two things.
Mm-hmm.
So the three kind of step success sequence is this: one, graduate from high school; two, maintain a full-time job or have a partner who does; and three, have children while married, should these millennials choose to become parents at all. So
mm-hmm.
you if you want to, quote, be successful, by the way this study determines it, you don't want to do those three steps out of order.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, logically makes sense. You know, I mean, a lot of times, at least this is how I've thought I should graduate high school, then I should get a full-time job, then I should have children. I got married before I had a full-time job, so I didn't do it in the exact order, but not everyone does it that way. And I think it's important to note that's not the only way to be successful. There are plenty of successful people I know who have not followed these steps one by one. But in their study, they seem to think that this is a way to more likely ensure success.
Mm-hmm. I find it interesting when you say millennials are having children before they're getting married. And I sometimes find it fascinating when they use language like, all of a sudden, we found ourselves pregnant.
Yeah. Yeah, it is interesting that they would use a language like that. I think a lot of times people just don't think about the consequences of their actions. They're more concerned about what's going on in the moment than what could result of their actions. I think that's true of sex. I think that's just true of life in general.
Mm-hmm.
Especially young people tend to act impulsively. You know, they say your brain's not fully developed until you're, what, like 25 or something like that. So I think it's fair to say that young people and presently young people are millennials. A significant portion of millennials could be considered young people. And, I think a lot of times millennials just act impulsively and they don't understand the consequences their actions could have. And then they, you know, have to live with the results, whatever they choose to do in that situation.
Yeah. Now, you're a pretty normal guy. So, Chris, I'm going to say that your idea of the American dream probably came from a long tradition of American dreams your parents and grandparents had. But the American dream is changing, isn't it? The landscape is changing for millennials?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that millennials don't have traditional ideas of success. So that's where this kind of study is interesting and may clash with how millennials see success. So this study is defining success as just being financially stable. It's
mm-hmm.
basically like, they don't talk about happiness in this study. They don't talk about fulfillment. They don't talk about spiritual stuff in this study, spiritual fulfillment or feeling close to God or anything like that. They're largely talking about financial success. Millennials, in my experience, and it's not safe to make generalizations like this, but I'm going to, millennials largely don't define success in financial terms. So while this study is saying, oh, here's this the sequence for success for millennials, and they base that success largely on dollars and cents, millennials would likely say, that's not how I would define success. Now, millennials would be foolish if they would say they don't care about money at all, because you kind of have to in order to survive.
Mm-hmm.
But I think millennials would define success more as feeling of fulfillment, happiness, contentment, doing what I want in life, or, you know, quote, and I kind of cringe when I hear this phrase, but you hear it often, like living my truth and being who I was meant to be or who I want to be, regardless. And for some, that may need that finding that truth and being true to themselves may need some sort of financial gain.
Mm-hmm.
But for a lot of them, that's going to be more found in having a family, even if it's not a traditional way we understand a family to be and how we see the scripture talk about families. Or it's going to be serving communities and doing good, or, you know, success is not going to necessarily be defined financially.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where kind of this study and millennial lifestyles may kind of conflict a little bit.
All right, Chris, you wrote an interesting column about seven surprising facts about the LGBT community. I want to talk about that when we come back. It is 47 minutes after the hour. We'll be back in just a minute more with Chris Martin. All right, it's almost 10 minutes until the top of the hour. Bill Arnold here talking to Chris Martin. Chris is a millennial evangelical working as an author development specialist at Lifeway Resources, Christian Resources. And he's also having lunch today with Trevin Wax. And where are you guys going to lunch?
We're going to Chewy's. It's his like favorite restaurant in the world. It's okay. A Tex-Mex place if you've never been to it before.
I've seen it before.
I don't think there are many. Yeah, I don't think there are many up in the upper Midwest.
There's
but it's
not,
like
but
a Tex-Mex place.
Yeah, I've been to Chewy's. I've been to Chewy's. Yeah, they're good. All right, you wrote an interesting article about seven surprising facts about the LGBT community.
Yeah, so
you left
yesterday,
the queue out, by the way.
Yeah, well, Gallup left
okay.
it out. So because I thought about that, I was like, do I need to put Q in here?
Yeah.
And Gallup, the polling agency released data yesterday, new data on the LGBT community and how they are in relationships. So
this is Gallup data.
Correct. So it's been about 2 years, almost exactly, since the Obergefell decision
mm-hmm.
that legalized gay marriage in the United States.
Okay.
And so they have, I think, judging by the study, it looks like they've done the last 2 years, they've studied LGBT relationship trends and how they're marrying each other or not, and how the LGBT community is viewed. Some of the data that we're going to look at here in a minute is from the study released yesterday, and some of it's actually from a study 2 years ago. So here's perhaps two of the facts kind of fused together make the most interesting observation of this whole thing for me. 13.1% of LGBT Americans are married to someone of the opposite sex.
Hmm.
And 10.2% of LGBT Americans are married to someone of the same sex. So about 3% fewer LGBT Americans are married to someone of the same sex. Now, there are a number of reasons that more LGBT Americans could be married to someone of the opposite sex than someone of the same sex. You would expect those numbers to be flipped mm-hmm. and perhaps the disparity to be higher. You know, maybe 25% of LGBT Americans are married to someone of the same sex and 10% are married to someone of the same sex. I think because, you know, there could be some that didn't realize that they were or didn't decide to live out their LGBT lifestyle and pursuits until they were already married and mm-hmm. they've remained in that relationship, but they identify as LGBT. You could have you know, you have bisexual and transsexual in this transgender in this acronym. So the bisexual or transgender Americans could be married to someone of the opposite sex. So the majority of the 13% could be made up of people who aren't lesbian or gay.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, those are just a couple of reasons it could be. But I think that's an interesting – it's kind of odd to me. later, we look at in the third kind of stat I share, 4.3% of American adults identify as LGBT. That's really low. It's up from a couple years ago. That's really low in the eyes of most Americans because as of 2015, and it's probably even higher now, as of 2015, about 33% or a third of Americans believe that the LGBT population is higher than 25%.
Wow.
So about a third of Americans believe that more than a quarter of Americans identify as LGBT. Hmm. That's really high. On average, Americans believe about 23% of the U.S. is LGBT. So basically, most of the U.S. thinks a quarter of the United States is LGBT, which is fascinating when only 4.3% of us actually are. I think that's largely because the voice for LGBT support is so high.
Yeah.
It's so loud because a lot of people who advocate for LGBT rights and the LGBT community in general – are do not identify that way.
Okay.
And so it seems like the community is louder than it actually is.
Yeah. Chris, you like data. You're a data person, aren't you?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
And here's some data and some math. Let's just look at this for a second. Let's just say 4.3% of Americans identify as LGBT. Let's just say for simple math reasons, there's 300 million people in America, and half of them are adults, so that leaves 150 million. So if 4.3% identify as LGBT, which is a bit over 6 million and 10% are married, that's 600,000 that are married. Those are not big numbers. And we have changed the laws and the culture, and only 500,000 people have bothered to change their life for it, their lifestyle.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's, there are a number of ways you can look at that. I think, yes, that's true. I think it's been 2 years.
Okay.
I'll be interested to see some more longitudinal data on this, some more long-term data, mm-hmm. you know, in 10 years after Obergefell. So in what, 2025? What's it going to look like in 2025? Because another interesting stat that came out of this study is 55.7% or 56% of LGBT Americans are single or have never been married. That's up by almost 10% from 2 years ago when the Obergefell decision happened.
Mm-hmm.
So that seems odd, right? You would expect the single rate to go down. I think simply that as the percentage of LGBT Americans slowly increase and as more and more, you know, younger, young 20-something LGBT Americans start getting polled in these studies, your rate of singleness is going to go up for a little bit. I think what will be more interesting is when we kind of have the first generation of LGBT Americans go through – the stage of life where you typically get married. So between, you know, 25 and 35 nowadays,
mm-hmm.
which is later than it used to be, I think it'll be interesting to see what the marriage stats look like then. Because I think what we'll have is, you know, Obergefell went into law a couple years ago, and assuming it doesn't get reversed for the sake of discussing here, it'll be interesting more to see long term how that affects the LGBT community. I think the data shows a small surge of LGBT Americans getting married in the couple of years since Obergefell. I mean, the percentage of married LGBT Americans increased by a few percentage points. So it did increase. But I think it'll be easier to discern kind of like real implications of Obergefell and legalization of gay marriage a few years later from now, in a few years when there have been a few more years for the community to kind of get its footing and it's in this new climate, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. All right, Chris, we're almost out of time, but this would be the final Jeopardy question. How many Christians, how do we as Christians live out our mission in this environment and make sure your answer is in the form of a question?
What is loving people and sharing the gospel with people with the understanding that they may either be LGBT or support the LGBT community. And what I mean by that is we should be smart about how we talk. We should not capitulate on gay marriage or homosexual activity. And we should maintain that those ideas are sinful, but we should love people anyway and be careful about what kind of language we use in talking about the LGBT community.
Nice. That's the correct answer. How much did you bet? $5,000.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
There you go. Have a great weekend, Chris. Good luck to your cubbies this weekend. Yep.
Yeah,
all right, thanks. It's 3 minutes until the top of the hour. We'll take a short break and be right back. All right, this weekend, memorize Galatians 2:20. I've been crucified with Christ, and I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. The life I live in the body, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. Have a great weekend. I'll see you Monday. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show. Connecting.